Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Congressman Paul Tonko wants ICE abolished. As the Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor reports, it comes as a negative sentiment toward federal immigration crackdowns is growing.
This agency, as it exists and operates, cannot continue. In my opinion, ICE needs to be abolished.
The 20th District Democrat has been a vocal opponent of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Tonko has signed onto an effort to impeach U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. And he's voted against an appropriations funding bill for DHS. In his office Thursday, Tonko went a step further, calling for the total abolition of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency that has operated since 2003. The congressman's outcry comes after two 37-year-olds, Renee Good and Alex Preddy, were shot and killed by federal immigration agents earlier this month. Tonko compared Preddy's death to the civil rights-era treatment of protesters.
This brutalization and these scenes of brutality that we have witnessed in Minnesota draw eerie parallels to the horrors of Bloody Sunday.
Bloody Sunday refers to a 1965 protest during which hundreds of activists sought to march from Selma to Montgomery to advocate for voting rights. The marchers, who were led by activists like the late John Lewis, were stopped by law enforcement on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, beaten with clubs and sprayed with tear gas. That's according to the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Having served with John and hearing his stories, you just can't help but wonder what John Lewis would be thinking in this given moment. No matter which side of the political aisle you stand on, the horror of these events should be self-evident. The stark and devastating reality is that two people who should be in the arms of their families today have instead been killed in the street.
Zoe Oxley, a political science professor from Union College, said Tonko's comparison is apt.
I think he is spot on in making that connection.
The professor says the recent violence committed by ICE agents seems quite similar to the violence that was inflicted on people involved in the civil rights movement.
In both cases, the violence led to some shifts in public opinion. In one case, the shift seems to be really today the public is turning more and more opposed to the activities of ICE and to the Trump immigration agenda more broadly, just as during the civil rights movement time, the public did start to shift opinions regarding the goals of civil rights protesters, including around voting rights after the Selma March.
Opposition to ICE activity has been a focal point in the Capital Region in recent days. On Wednesday, state lawmakers announced they were signing onto a national statement decrying the actions of federal immigration enforcement entities like ICE and U.S. Border Patrol. 46th District State Senator Pat Fahey said that the scope of ICE's crackdown in the Capital Region is unknown, and leaders have been relying on the work from nonprofits like the New York State Immigration Coalition for information.
Right now, too much of it is anecdotal, and we're relying on a lot of advocacy groups to do the legal work and more.
On Wednesday, the Capital Region Sanctuary Coalition, a group that documents ICE activity, posted on social media that ICE had taken two adults and three children in Clifton Park. And in December, four members of an Albany-based Afghan family were taken by ICE outside of a mosque on Central Ave. WAMC has reached out to the coalition for a request for comment. Tonko could not give an exact measure of the level of ICE activity within the 20th District, but says there has been an upswing in arrests. He says ICE and Secretary Noem need to be held accountable.
People have watched this performance. They've watched the unprofessional, irresponsible carrying forth of a mission that has really tarnished an agency and have found them failing in their mission to address public safety.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not immediately respond to a request for comment. I'm Jesse Taylor.
Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul is weighing in on ICE after federal agents shot and killed a man videotaping protests in Minneapolis. The governor is promising to punish the federal leaders she says are responsible. We get more from the New York Public News Network's Dave Bullard.
Governor Kathy Hochul denounced the shooting and what she called a pattern of violence by federal agents.
When federal agents use lethal force against civilians and then prevent state authorities from fully investigating, it violates the basic principles of a democracy. What it does is makes everyone feel unsafe. Everyone.
Hochul called for Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to resign, be fired by the president, or impeached and removed by Congress. She said Noem lies when she calls protesters domestic terrorists and has shown a profound disregard for human life. Hochul then issued a warning.
When these people who have abused the power entrusted to them by their offices are finally out of power, states including New York will hold them accountable.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Dave Bullard.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang to talk with her about the agency's 40th birthday.
I'm so excited to be here to talk to New Yorkers about our work because it is 40 years ago that former Governor Mario Cuomo signed the executive order establishing the offices of the New York State Inspector General. But the legacy of inspectors general dates way back before that. And so coincident with America 250, we wanted to celebrate our 40th birthday and the American legacy of oversight here in New York, in large part because Baron von Steuben, who is credited as being America's first inspector general.
Say that name again. I love it.
Baron von Steuben.
The Baron.
The Baron. He served under George Washington and helped turn the tide of the war at Valley Forge and beyond. And he was responsible for establishing parameters and rules and regulations for the military that changed what was a volunteer force into a much more professionalized army. He, in fact, then went on to write the rules and regulations known as the Blue Book that still forms the basis for military
rules
and
regulations. And you had that Blue Book.
We did, and that one of the original Blue Books is in the incredible collection of New York Parks and Historic Preservation at Peebles Island. And we were so glad to have that and a number of other objects related to the Baron on site at the New York State Museum last night, including his pocket watch.
Well, I keep thinking about this quote that was above the chalkboard in my history class in high school. And it said, if we do not learn from our mistakes, we are doomed to repeat them. So knowing our history, and specifically the history of the Inspector General, is important for understanding our democracy. Can you help us with that a little bit? I mean, when you're talking about Baron von Steuben, we're going back to the Continental Congress days, aren't we?
That's right. And largely after those days, inspectors general were a military construct. And really, about 150 years ago or so, the construct moved into the municipal context with the development of the Department of Investigations in New York City. And I was so thrilled to be joined by New York City's longest serving inspector general, former DOI Commissioner Rose Gill, who talked about the origins of that office, which stemmed from the scandals around Tammany Hall and was the beginnings of inspectors general in the civilian tradition, which led ultimately to the creation of the Federal Inspector General's Act that led to the development of what is now 73 IGs at the federal level and a number of state and municipal IGs who have sprung up, including our office 40 years ago.
We're speaking with New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang. And I remind you, we have a very, very, very special guest coming up shortly on the program. So stay tuned. But one of the things that always bothered me, I guess, as a young person when I started studying politics was the realization that the lawmakers would not pass laws that would get themselves in trouble. Right? Why hoist themselves on their own petard? And because of the potential for power and corruption and those kinds of things, You need an agency to watch over these folks. And in the end, it's about, as your mission statement says, fostering confidence in government, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is so critically important, especially now, that there are nonpartisan, independent folks within government who have access to the materials and the people who run government in order to conduct investigations into allegations of fraud and corruption, but also who are able to do programmatic analysis for the kinds of services that serve everyday New Yorkers and Americans, as the case may be. So in addition to our investigations that may lead to criminal outcomes, we also assess a whole range of the kinds of programs that affect New Yorkers every day, from the prison system to the welfare system and everything in between.
You know, you spoke out right after the purging of these inspector generals. The Trump administration clearly is trying to remove oversight in all types of agencies. I mean, we're even seeing now with the Environmental Protection Agency trying to loosen rules for the pollution that goes downwind, and that means us in the Northeast. These kinds of things can make things worse, more dangerous, unhealthy, and can cost municipalities and states and the country money, wasted money, which is a big deal. But I wondered, you know, you're not afraid, as so many people seem intimidated these days to come out and speak out against the administration. How come and why is it so important to speak out?
I feel so lucky to be a New Yorker now and always, to be in a state where I am granted the independence that's required to do my job and to work in and amongst communities that care about these issues. And so I will, as long as I have a soapbox, be preaching the import of the kind of oversight that we do, both for the purposes of making government work better and for helping people understand that so much of government is working for them.
Yeah, you know, we do spend a lot of time criticizing government, and yet many of the basic functions we come to rely on are a result of how government works. But you're there to make sure it's working and working right. And of course, another part of your role in looking over the state agencies is looking over the executive. So you also have to keep your eyes on the governor, and you have to have the sort of gut to do that. What gives you that confidence and ability?
I bring to this work the same values that I have brought to my whole career, starting as a prosecutor and working in the nonprofit sector. And that is really a commitment to the rule of law. So when we, for example, began an investigation several years ago after a shootout between a CUNY police officer and the NYPD, that led to us uncovering some deficiencies in CUNY's policies related to guns, we did a comprehensive look at how guns were handled across the executive agencies and discovered that there was a lack of consistency amongst them, that there was a need for changes with respect to how guns are handled on and off the job, to security related to state guns. And no one tried to stop us, as they shouldn't have, in saying the state's doing something wrong here and it needs to change.
That's New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York's child poverty rate ranks in the bottom 10 in the country, and it's been that way for a while now. Advocates are hoping that recent policy changes will start to make a difference, but they worry that federal cuts could negate the gains. The New York Public News Network's Amy Feiereisel reports.
New York's child poverty rate is bad. Kari Siddiqui is with the Schuyler Center and coordinates the New York Can End Child Poverty Coalition.
18% of kids across New York State are living in poverty.
In many upstate cities like Syracuse, Binghamton, and Rochester, the number of children living in poverty is upwards of 40%. To try to change that, the state legislature passed the Child Poverty Reduction Act in 2021. Its goal was to cut New York's child poverty rate in half over a decade. Unfortunately, 5 years in, not much has changed, says Siddiqui.
So we're now about halfway towards that goal, and we really haven't seen the rate of child poverty reduce yet. However, we have made some pretty significant investments.
One of the biggest policy changes to come from the Reduction Act is only just now taking effect. That's the expansion of New York's child tax credit. Starting on January 1st, that credit increased from $330 to $1,000 per child under the age of four. Next year, the amount will increase for children aged 4 to 17.
And so this is a really significant investment and is estimated to reduce child poverty by about 9%. Despite that, though, we still have a really long way to go to reach that goal.
Another marker that child poverty advocates pay close attention to is food insecurity rates. Siddiqui says that's a clear indicator of financial strain on families. And those also look quite grim in New York right now.
One in five children around New York State experience food insecurity, which means that they did not have adequate access to food sometimes or often.
Now, there is some potential relief coming from the child care front. If New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani and Governor Kathy Hochul get their way, New York is on the verge of embarking on an incredibly ambitious child care expansion. Besides rent, child care is typically a family's largest expense. Hochul and Mamdani hope making child care more accessible and affordable will bring relief to families and the overall economy. But those policies will take time to put into place. Siddiqui has concerns about how federal cuts could make things worse in the state before they get better. For example, cuts to the nation's largest anti-hunger program, SNAP, formerly known as food stamps.
H.R. 1, the federal bill, made some really significant changes to SNAP, which will result in more families and children experiencing food insecurity, almost certainly.
Last fall, the federal government also announced it was discontinuing the USDA's annual food security report, calling it, quote, redundant, costly, and extraneous. Siddiqui says that report has long been a critical tracking tool.
And this is worrisome, as it is a loss of our ability to measure the problem, which then results in making it a lot more difficult for us to address those problems.
Governor Hochul has signaled in her recent budget proposal that the state does intend to fill some of the gaps left behind by federal cuts. Siddiqui says the issue of child poverty will need that help if New York has any hope of reducing its rate by 2031. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
New York State lawmakers have announced legislation targeting the New York State Office of Court Administration's power over municipal budgets. The Legislative Gazette's Sejina Shrestha has details.
The city of Schenectady could lose more than $13 million in state funding as a result of having inadequate court facilities. That's because current state law says cities that do not abide by the Office of Court Administration's court facility compliance rules risk losing state funding. Schenectady is currently negotiating with the OCA to keep that money. But Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy, a Democrat, calls the OCA's funding control problematic.
OCA can make the determination, and then the city has to pay for it. And I don't do that with my fire department or police department. There has to be some negotiation when you're going through the expenditure of public funds.
Capital Region state lawmakers say they agree with McCarthy. Standing in the Schenectady City Hall Rotunda Friday, the legislators explained that the court administration office is often seen as uncooperative. Lawmakers say this is the main reason why they introduced legislation aiming to strip OCA of its power to withhold funding. Democratic Assembly member Angelo Santa Barbara of Rotterdam says the solutions OCA gives for bringing court facilities up to compliance do not always have the needs of a city in mind.
What does it mean? It means less money to the fire department, less police patrols, sanitation. People that work at City Hall, that make the city function, they don't know if their paychecks are going to clear. It is devastating, and they know this. They know this going in, and they made a decision anyway. And that's what has to stop. This bill restores balance and fairness.
The proposed legislation would create an independent court facility review panel. Two members in the panel would be elected by state assembly members and state senators. The panel would also create an appeals process for cities to negotiate with the OCA. State Senator Patricia Fahey, a Democrat representing the 46th District, says the bill would facilitate better communication between the OCA and cities throughout the state.
We think there's got to be a better process, which is what we are proposing in this legislation, to have a process where it's a true two-way negotiation, And in the meantime, we are all saying, restore those funds. It is wrong to intercept monies that we in the legislature authorized last spring in the state budget.
Schenectady has been aware of its non-compliant court facilities for some time. As previously reported by WAMC, a 2013 letter addressed to now fourth-term Mayor Gary McCarthy said the city lacks an appropriate-sized courtroom for the criminal caseload. It also said the civil division lacks a dedicated courtroom for handling of traffic matters. WAMC has also previously reported that in 2023, McCarthy was sent another letter, which again requested the city develop and submit a plan to update its facilities. The city currently holds criminal court at the police station and civil and traffic court in City Hall. In an email to WAMC about Schenectady's court facilities, OCA wrote Friday that the city of Schenectady has failed to meet court standards for a long time. They added, quote, the OCA has simply been seeking to ensure that the public has safe, clean, functioning courthouses that can accommodate the delivery of high-quality justice in a timely manner, unquote. Santa Barbara says this issue goes beyond the city of Schenectady.
This can happen to anybody, anywhere in the state of New York. And it's been happening. There's communities that have been strong-armed. They've been forced to do unreasonable things. And it has cost the taxpayers. It has hurt residents. And in this case, withholding critical state aid is just plain wrong. This is the nuclear option.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Sagina Shrestha.
It's been a year since the Newburgh Beacon Ferry stopped running and was replaced by a free shuttle bus. As the Legislative Gazette's Elias Guerra reports, some are rolling with the change while others miss the boat.
On a recent early morning, the Route 17K park and ride shuttle bus stop was cold and empty.
It is 8:23 a.m. The coach warming center is closed.
Last January, the Newburgh Beacon Ferry stopped running when winter ice damaged the Beacon dock. In its place is the Newburgh Beacon shuttle bus. Sheila Lucas moved up to Newburgh from the Bronx and recently discovered the shuttle bus. She says it fits her needs, plus it's free.
I would take a taxi every day to the Beacon station. And then I come to find out that I could take the shuttle for free.
But advocates like Carson Carter from Save the Ferry say riding the shuttle does not compare at all.
The ferry was really a magical experience. Boarding Newburgh at sunset, especially in the summer, and headed over to Beacon. Just an 8-minute ride, but if the weather was good, I always sat on top. And it's one of the most magnificent views anywhere. It's the New York State seal. The view of Mount Beacon from Newburgh.
One longtime rider, Sonia Grant, started taking the ferry in 2005 when the MTA resumed service. The ferry stopped operating in 1963 after 220 years of service. Grant says the ferry gave her community and calm.
I was one of the first ferry riders when the ferry returned in 2005, and it quickly became an anchor in my life. It's about giving future generations in Newburgh and the surrounding areas the same opportunity to thrive.
Carter says she understands concerns about low ridership and costs. She thinks the MTA could make the ferry more accessible, more environmental, and design a better schedule for all riders' needs. She said more outreach could increase ridership and boost tourism. In June, Metro North officials announced the ferry would be permanently discontinued, citing low ridership of around 62 riders a day in 2024, and high operating costs of around $2.1 million annually. But Save the Ferry says if the Beacon-Newburgh ferry ran like the Ossining-Haverstraw ferry, about 30 miles south, it would be far more useful to riders. The Ossining-Haverstraw ferry runs from about 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on weekdays and 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on weekends. Carter said the Beacon ferry was not planned well.
Yeah, I would point out that the ridership was low by design because it was not a multimodal system.
Carter says for the ferry to run better, it needs to be better connected to other forms of transit, like buses. It could also serve as an essential connection between Newburgh and Beacon.
But this ferry was an essential conduit. It's a very wide river at this stretch. You've basically got the one option of the bridge.
One rider, Jessica Kuhn, moved to Newburgh in 2019 and commutes from the city. She says the ferry was one of the main draws for her to the area.
So I was pretty devastated when it stopped running. I take the bus shuttle that has been placed in lieu of the ferry. So what was a commute for me that was maybe 2 hours, maybe a little under 2 hours, last night it took me 3 hours to get home.
Kuhn says without the ferry, she probably would have moved elsewhere and thinks the missing ferry service could affect Beacon and Newburgh's growth.
Okay, if the ferry wasn't existing then, I don't know if I would have chosen that particular area. And I just wonder what that will do to the growth of Newburgh and the surrounding areas.
In December, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced the shuttle would expand service by 60%. Starting this month, a total of 65 trips between the two cities run from 4:55 a.m. and 11:50 p.m. at no cost to riders. But Kuhn said the ferry is an integral part of Beacon and Newburgh and cannot be replaced.
Well, it's just a really lovely way to like start and end your day. It's just like a boat ride across the Hudson. You really can't get any better than that. But it was also the sense of community that you would see the same people on the ferry. You got to know them. And it was just a really nice community that feels broken now. This is a public service that our tax dollars pay for and should be given to us.
Lucas said the shuttle serves all of her needs.
When I first hopped in it, I was surprised because I'm like, oh, okay, are these like the buses? This is the shuttle. It's nice. They have, you could charge your phone there. It's comfortable. It's comfortable and it's free. Who doesn't like free?
Yeah. I'm Elias Guerra.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. Look for program number 2605. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.